We're talking with Jacques Vallée about Trinity, the Best Kept Secret, a book he co-wrote with Paula Harris. Fascinating story, incredibly detailed about something that crashed, fell out of the sky, hit a communications tower and crashed on a ranch near San Antonio, New Mexico, had three occupants on board. So what became of them? We're going to hear more about that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. In the book, Trinity, the Best Kept Secret, there's a very vivid description of these three beings that were seen inside the downed craft that land on the ranch, the Padilla Ranch. You describe it, Jacques, you and Paula describe them as they had these tiny little ears, a little slit for a mouth, and their heads were shaped like pears, according to the boys, the witnesses. And when they stood up, they kind of looked like fire ants, he says. Their skin was gray, or maybe it was a uniform, they speculated. But so these beings were in there. They're kind of walking around and are very upset. And there was communication of a sort with the boys, right? These images start popping into their heads. Can you share with us that part of the story?
Those images will stay with them in dreams that come back, you know, for a number of years. Jose told me that, you know, as he grew up, he had those recurring dreams that would wake him up in the middle of the night. Dreams of buildings falling, of things falling from the sky, just stopping in midair, and that this would, you know, this is an experience he would have for 2 or 3 years, and after that he ceased having those dreams, but he remembered them vividly. There was no direct communication, overt communication with the beings. They did not look directly at the boys, but there seemed to be this sort of intense psychic transfer that took place and that stayed with them. I want to go a little bit faster because there is a lot of things happened after that. The kids are now there every day. They hide. They know how to hide. You know, in the bushes around the site, they leave their horses tied up, you know, at some distance away, and they sort of follow this because, you know, this is obviously extremely exciting to them. It takes a couple of days for the army to cut the fence, build the road. By the way, the fence is a 27-foot gate that they install there. So this is not just, you know, a weather balloon you could have taken out with a Jeep. Again, we'll find out that it's the weight, the total weight is 4.5 to 5 tons. The boys are on site on the 21st. So the crash happened on the 16th of August, that's a Thursday. On Tuesday, the truck arrives with a low boy. On the Wednesday, the soldiers bring a cherry picker to lift the object. They build a crane. They build an A-frame over the low boy to bring the object on the platform. They put a tarp around the object. They put the object on the side because if they leave it upright, it's not going to go under the overpass. Again, those are not things that you make up just out of thin air. I mean, this corresponds to day by day what happened. And the soldiers would periodically go to a local little tavern, a little restaurant that's still there. They were where we've had many pleasant meals with Jose Padilla. The two kids go there occasionally to help in the kitchen, you know, to prepare the meat and to play around the restaurant. So they know, they see the soldiers go there, you know, to talk to the waitresses and to eat and to drink. And then they go back and continue the work around the craft. On the Thursday, the 23rd, they have the A-frame built. they lift the object, and on the last day, on Saturday the 25th, the guards relax. There is nothing more to be done. The avocado is on its side with a tarp around it, sitting on the platform, and they are ready to take it back to White Sands. And there, you know, on that day, it's not guarded anymore for a couple of hours. And then the kids are still there, and they really want to go inside. At least Jose wants to go inside, and he will. Now, his father has gone inside as soon as the thing was reported. The father has gone there with a state of New Mexico police officer named Apodaca, and they've gone inside. The kids could see them inside the object. When the two adults came out, they set the kids down and they told them, look, this is big. This is not just, you know, some little thing that happened. The army is going to be there. It's going to be a big thing. You don't talk about it ever. This is, we're still technically at war. This is grave. This is a serious thing. You don't talk about it. And we're not going to tell you what we found inside. And Jose still talks about it like something that those words were seared into his memory. And they are not going to talk about it for 65 years. When they discuss it at school, they go out of the school. They go to a place where they can have their sandwich and so on. And, and they'll talk about it privately. Or they go to the ranch and they go to the land to talk about it. They never talk about it in front of adults or in front of other kids at school. And again, this is something, I mean, there were things that I can relate to there. You know, they were, the town where I was born was occupied by the German army. There were two bridges that were critical to the English and the American troops, of course, that they needed to cut off so that the Germans could not reinforce the beachhead in the fight in Normandy, where there was an American beachhead after D-Day. And though I saw all that, and the things I saw, my parents said, you don't talk about that. You know, if you see a German soldier or a German officer, you don't look him in the eye. You go to the other, you cross the road and you mind your own business. You don't talk to them. You don't talk to other people about what you see. And I can relate to that. I that was true in Europe as it was true in the U.S. around that time. In that little cafe, by the way, where we've gone, those posters are still there. You know, you just don't talk. And on that last day, Jose goes inside. He gets Remy to get a what he calls a cheetah bar. I've learned a lot of American slang, you know, over the, following Paola around on that ranch. I said, "What's a cheetah bar?" Well, a cheetah bar is really a crowbar, but that was a term that was used around, you know, in those days. And it was always on the truck because you needed it to secure the cargo that you would rope around on the platform. So he gets a cheetah bar from Remy and he goes in, and there is an instrument there, which is a rotating bracket around something that looks like a copper circle on the plate that's affixed to the wall. Now, if there are other things that were there inside the craft, the soldiers have taken them out. We know the soldiers spent a lot of time picking up all the debris around, so nothing was left except maybe a few things that were recovered later by the father. But the only thing that the kids recovered, other than some fibers that had that were on the landscape from the hit against the tower. They recovered that in a big sack of about 40 pounds, and they are going to use it later for their own amusement, because to them it's a toy. It's bright. These bright fibers are, and we're going to talk about them later, because they're another child is going to come into the family later and is going to see all of that from later. And Sabrina, who that Paola discovered, we've interviewed her and we've brought her back to the site so that she could explain what she saw when she became part of the family later. And she saw all the artifacts that had been recovered that were still scattered around the landscape, that the soldiers hadn't been able to get all of it. But most of it they got, so it's all packaged and it's ready to go. So Jose gets that bracket out from the thing on the wall. He cannot get the panel itself. The panel is about 2 feet by 3 feet with this crown of something bright that looks like copper, probably is copper. And we have the bracket. So going back to the people who say we made all that up, you know, and that bracket was, you know, if there is a bracket, it's just an ordinary bracket. I agree with them. It probably is an ordinary bracket. The composition is known. By the way, there are two very good books about this whole thing. There is a book by Ryan Wood called Magic Eyes Only that we've used as a reference. He mentions a case. He spends 6 pages on that case based on the testimony that was finally given by the kids about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, which is when Paola went and interviewed both of them. Ryan did not interview the kids, but he relates it in his book, which is a compilation of crashes. It's a very good compilation of all the known crashes. The other book is a book called let me just check it. Magic, not Magic Eyes Only, but it's called
you know what, we'll look it up.
Yeah, well, you can look it up. It's a book by Timothy Good that describes the analysis, the first analysis of the bracket, and there is no question it's an ordinary object. And I think that it's an ordinary object that the soldiers brought to either to help some equipment inside the craft when they were cleaning it up, and when they were studying it. It could have been used to wrap a wire around, an electrical wire, because they were there at night, and they would work, they would also work at night. So they needed to bring a light inside the object. I think that's what it was, and there is no controversy there. People are trying to make a big controversy out of it. By the way, some of my science friends who are studying the bracket and taking it apart, redoing the analysis, don't agree with me. They think there could be something special about that piece of equipment. But we have it. We have it in the lab, and we are studying it, because it's pretty rare that the witnesses succeed in getting something out of the object. Then the truck went back to White Sands and the object was never seen again. So the question is, and it's a legitimate question, and that's why people, you know, argue that the case is could be a hoax and so on. Why didn't the witnesses speak for 65 years, and why is there no trace of it in Project Blue Book and in the Air Force files? Well, you know, for one thing, there was no Air Force. So Project Blue Book is many years in the future at that point. The Air Force is 2 years in the future, the American Air Force, as distinguished from the Army. So those files, and I've, as you know, I spent 4 years going through the Blue Book files to computerize, to redo the analysis of the files for, in part for the for Project Blue Book under Dr. Hynek. So I know those files pretty well. I've gone back to my records. There are only four cases that Project Blue Book had from 1945. One of them was probably a UFO. It was in Germany. The other three could be explained. One of them was a civilian in Texas who saw the mushroom cloud over White Sands at the time of the first atomic explosion, which is sort of an interesting, interesting side effect of the whole story. The kids never spoke because, again, they had been impressed by their parents and by their father and by the policeman that you should not talk about it. This is something the government is doing. This is something that the army is going to deal with. We don't have to deal with it. It happened on our land, but now it's the truck is gone. It's over. You don't talk about it. Now, why is there no official record? Well, we think we know that because, again, there is additional evidence that the object would have been taken to the Manhattan Project, and then after the Manhattan Project, the Atomic Energy Commission was created. Of course, Los Alamos became a center of research. Further research into atomic physics, both civilian and military. On that side, there are three secrecy systems in the United States. There is the system that everybody talks about, secret, top secret, confidential, above top secret, and so on. And those belong to, of course, the Pentagon and the main agencies of the American government. The State Department has its own foreign secret system that, of course, is brought to the attention of the rest of the government when the need arises, but it's a separate system. And then the atomic secrets are the R, P, and Q classification, and they are separate from everything else because they are the nuclear secrets. And most of the mainstream secrecy and clearance system does not infringe on the nuclear field. And only people who are briefed on that or have been trained in nuclear physics have the need to know for the nuclear secrets. We think that's where the object was taken, that's where it was studied, and that's under that system of classification that that the information has been kept. Remy Baca became a businessman in the state of Washington.
I'll tell you what, Jacques, we're going to have to take another break. We'll pick this up on the other side. Going into the break, talking with Jacques Vallée about his book, Trinity, the Best Kept Secret. We're talking with Jacques Vallée about Trinity, the Best Kept Secret, a well-documented book about this incredible incident that happened just about a month after the Trinity test in New Mexico, 1945. The primary witnesses were kids at the time, but there's a lot of supporting material and evidence that Jacques and his co-author Paula Harris were able to dig up, including some people who came looking to see what happened to their communication tower that was cut off after this thing, this craft, smashed into it. We're going to hear that part of the story next in the segment of Coast to Coast AM. Jacques, there's still so much to cover, but one thing I definitely want to touch on in our last segment with you is the people who at White Sands who recognized that their communications tower was down, that this thing really did smash into it, and it cut off communications for that part of the White Sands range, and they came looking, right?
Well, what happened is as the object had just crashed, there was a B-29 was coming in for a landing at Alamogordo, which is inside the huge white sands area. And the communication control tower at Alamogordo asked him to look at the tower, because they said, we've lost communication at the north end of the end of range, and can you see what's wrong with the tower? So he circled the tower before landing and saw that it was bent, and then he saw the fire in the vegetation, and then he saw exactly what the two kids described to the two witnesses described to Paola, and what Jose describes to me now, that the bushes were on fire and there was this oval object there. He says in his report said that there were two Indian boys on horseback who were near the object that had crashed. So that really nails it, on that day exactly. So we have that confirmation. Of course, they were not Indian boys. Jose was part Indian through his grandmother, but Remy was actually from a Spanish family. The Baca family came from Spain. They didn't come from Mexico. So, but be that as it may, two boys on horses looked like Indian boys. But we know the name of the pilot, Sir Brody. His son is still alive and has the records of what he saw. At the other end, at the once Mr. Baca was in the state of Washington, he was a businessman. He helped the governor of Washington, the state of Washington, get elected. And she knew about the story, and she showed him. She didn't leave it with him, but she showed to him, to Remy Baca, the report on the crash. And this was Dixie Lee Ray, who was governor of the state of Washington, and that then went on to be chair of the Atomic Energy Commission from 73 to 75. In fact, she was governor of Washington after that from 1977 to 1981. And that's the time, 1977 would have been the time when she was traveling for her re-election with Remy Baca, who was a prominent businessman in the area. And she showed him the report confirming his observation as a kid. So again, it's with those two additional pieces of testimony, it's hard to say that the kids just made it up. Also, by the way, when you make up a story to be interesting, you don't wait 65 years to reveal it. This is not a joke. A joke that you keep to yourself for 65 years is not going to be very very effective. Remy Baca at that point had the bracket. He later gave it to Jose, which is why we have it. But he came out with the story to get it tested, and it was tested first at Los Alamos, and then by friends of his, of his family, and then it was tested also by a group of scientists from Australia who took an interest in the case, and we have their report, which has not been published, but it's a complete report on the analysis of the material, which we have redone. And, we agree essentially with what it says, that the object is an ordinary bracket based on aluminum with some other components. It's interesting because it's all the dimensions are in the metric system. The army did not use a metric system in 1945, and so we've recomputed. My colleagues have recomputed all the dimensions, and it's certainly not an army issue piece of equipment. On the other hand, the soldiers who were there, there were about a dozen soldiers on the site doing all this cleanup and this recovery. They were miles and miles away from a source of supply or anything else, so they could have improvised with some piece of equipment that was there. So people say, that we're lying, we're making it up, that this comes from a windmill. Well, it doesn't come from a windmill because Paola and other people on our team have gone to a supplier of windmill equipment. I mean, you find those in New Mexico. There are lots of windmills in all those ranches and farms. And that company has been there for many years, and they don't have a part like that. There could be actuators that might look like that for other things, for a water pump, for water mill. You could use the same kind. Essentially, it's a bracket that transfers a rotating movement to actuate certain valves or certain pieces of equipment. It could be within an airplane of the time. It could have been that kind of thing. Certainly not in an airplane today. It's not the kind of actuator you would use, but it could have been in an older type of plane, or in a truck, or in a machine used in the fields. So we think that's probably what it was, but you need to prove it. You can't just say, it's a hoax because we think that it resembles something we've seen before. You can't say that. I mean, that's not, if you're going to be scientific, you can't just make up a hypothesis and ignore everything else. So we are going step by step to document the whole case. Now, I'm an information scientist. I studied physics and astrophysics, but most of my career has been in computer science and in information science, and I look for patterns. Now, from what the kids report, what Sabrina Padilla reports of the other pieces of things that she has seen, including the fibers that we talked about, including other things that look like some of the things that allegedly have been found at Roswell, we can begin to reconstruct a pattern. Now, there are two other celebrated cases that I've studied at length, and I've published studies about them, where the object was avocado shape, not a disc, definitely not a disc, and where the so-called pilots or entities were short, were about 1.2 meters, about 4 feet or 4.5 feet, were breathing air like we do, had two eyes like we do, had a large head, narrow shoulders, and had some sort of a uniform, the case in Socorro and the case in Valensole in France. Both of those cases were studied by the army and by other agencies. The case in Valensole, I've been there. I spoke to the main witness. I spent several days there. I looked at the fields. I spoke to other people who had seen things in the area that they had not reported publicly or even to the police. The case in Valensole involved a man named Maurice Mas, who was a resistance leader during World War II. So he was taken very seriously by the gendarmes and by the police and by the army when they interviewed him. He had a field that he was watering early in the morning. Of course, that's in the south of France. It's very hot during the day. If you're going to work in the field, you'd better do it around dawn or in the early morning hours or at dusk. So he's there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and there is an object there. The object is an oval-shaped craft. It leaves traces after it leaves. It leaves holes in the ground that have been carefully documented later by the gendarmerie. He sees two occupants, describes them, and of course he has no idea of what had happened in New Mexico, because at that point, this is in 1965. This is in June 1965, April 1965. There has been no news about the case in New Mexico at all. And he describes the two creatures, the two humanoids who are looking at him. They have a uniform. They are outside the object. They are looking at him as he approaches. One of them has two objects on his belt, a large one and a small one. He picks out the small one, points it at him, and Maurice Mas is paralyzed. We've gone quite a bit with my friends in France into what kind of paralysis it was. My brother is a professor of medicine. I discussed that with him. He doesn't especially believe in UFOs. He does now. he explained to me the different kinds of paralysis there could be. Maurice Mas did not fall. He remained standing, but he couldn't want to move. He couldn't move. He could breathe. He could see. He saw the two creatures or humanoids get back into the object. The object took off and vanished in thin air. Okay? I mean, the people who say we're going to be tracking those things with satellites, well, you know, maybe, good luck. Or from telescopes on the ground, maybe, good luck. but in close encounter cases, very often the object disappears on the site. The other place is Socorro. I followed Socorro because Dr. Hynek went there. I've reconstructed the whole thing. We had all the people that he interviewed. Of course, he was sent there by Project Blue Book to try to explain away an oval object that was seen by a patrolman from Socorro, Lonnie Zamora, whose career was destroyed by ridicule of his own colleagues and the people from the Army or the Air Force who didn't want to believe in what he described. But there were traces there. I've gone to the site a couple of times. I've gone there I had the privilege of going there with taking the son of Dr. Hynek there, Paul Hynek, Dr. Paul Hynek. And there is no question this happened. And the Lonnie Zamora case, just like the New Mexico case, has been ridiculed, and people have said it was a hoax. Some people say still it was a hoax, or that it could be explained that there were special balloons. Again, you know, all these special balloons that do extraordinary things. Well, in the book, I go a lot into the pattern, into what happened in Valencel and what happened in Socorro especially. And I published there for the first time a case I had in my files since that comes to me from the files of Dr. Hynek of another sighting of the Socorro object that as it flew off from Socorro over White Sands and was seen at White Sands by an officer who was driving there who had a power failure of his car on the White Sands military range as he saw the object flying over White Sands and then going away and disappearing. This was an hour after the sighting by Officer Lonnie Zamora. Was never reported to the police. It was never reported to the Air Force. So, you know, after a few years, that's why it's good to be old, you know, because you can see now the tapestry. And after I've read all those books about the end of the war in Japan, which, by the way, drove me to tears, because the things the Japanese went through and the way they stopped the war is not what we've learned in school. They didn't stop the war simply because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Japanese army wanted to continue. The big battle was going to be in the north of Japan, where they were massing the troops of Japan behind fortifications that were the same kinds of fortifications from that we had in Normandy, that I know well, because I visited them at the War of the Atlantic, that the Germans erected to stop an invasion by the Americans and the Canadians and the British Army.
Jacques, we have about a minute left. I want to ask you one quick question. The beings, the occupants of the crew, the craft, there were three of them. They were gone. It wasn't because the Army came in and snatched them up. They were gone by the time the Army got there, right?
Well, we're not sure. Again, that was the one day when the kids were not there. They didn't see that. But somebody else, there is another case, if you read the book, where these creatures reappeared shortly after that incident. And it may have been the same creatures. Either they were picked up by their buddies, or they escaped after the crash. They may have been taken by Brody and his men when they came the second day to clean it up. The case is important because it's part of history. It's part of the atomic history. This is more important than the other crashes. The other crashes, of course, reinforce the pattern. But this case is real, and it happened in connection with the explosion of the first atomic bomb in New Mexico. And by the way, since then, we have never used an atomic bomb in battle. Think about that.
Yeah.
Why,
yes.
Why is it
that
we've never used a bomb? We were tempted to use it in Vietnam. We were tempted to use it in other places, in other conflicts, but it was never used.
Jacques Vallée, it's always great to have you here. You and Paula did a terrific job with Trinity, The Best Kept Secret. I encourage people to read it. It's a terrific book. And I know there's so much more that we want to cover, including metamaterials that you're testing now. Can't wait to hear what the results are. You're welcome here anytime.
Okay. Thank you very much, George.
Thank you. When we come back, Nick Redfern will join us.